Yeah. Sure.
We were wondering the two of us were moods, anthropological moods. In relation to what you're saying at the end of this talk about our problem being mourning, what do you think, and the survival of grief as a problem I've taken in modernity and therefore as symptomatic of a certain rupture with whatever it is for.
Absolutely.
So how is it that we can understand that things like faith are symptoms of this survival grief? We understand that with anthropological moods, if by that you mean something that's just the human being as creature has moments of suspicion in some, in an ahistorical sense, if it's an historical problem that we're trying to, or an ethical problem that we're trying to unpack. Why would we move to anthropology if it's an error that we're trying to?
Right, but we're you're certainly looking at an error. And the error is the disavowal of grief. But the disavowal of grief, I'm arguing, is an actualization of an underlying mood of suspicion. So suspicion, I'm claiming, is the underlying mood. And I'm saying that suspicion comes about at any moment. Right? I mean, I'm just... So the argument is something like I'm buying the argument that trust is a necessary condition for our experience of the world. And I'm assuming that if trust is that idea of always already being dependent on the world, then what endangers trust, that is, whenever we discover, as we always do, this is the argument, that our trust is not fully rational. Right? That's the problem, that everything we trust will let us down. We all know that. Right? But once you know that, then you have suspicion. Right? So suspicion and trust, I'm thinking, are underlying structures of permanent possibilities of our relationship to the fact of dependence. I'm not claiming that they are particularly modern. Rather, I'm arguing that what modernity does is, because of the discovery of subjectivity, it has to rethink that notion of dependence. Right. And now we're going to get the disavowal of grief because we're going to have the lost object. So you can think about it as loss of the authority of nature, or you can think of it as the death of God. Which is why Christianity is always melancholy. The founding fact of Christianity is God is dead. That's how it starts. Right there on the cross, we can point to him. That's a dead God. Right? And that reverberates in its ambiguity throughout the whole, I mean, we'll come to this, throughout the whole history of Christianity, of how seriously that loss is a loss, right? And that it becomes, hyperventilated at the very beginnings of modernity. Holbein's Dead Christ in the Tomb, or the Eisenheim altarpiece. That's a dead God. I mean, that's a really dead God, right? He's green.
Yeah,
grim. So is that help?
It does.
Okay. The suggestion, I don't have an account of this. The suggestion certainly of Kristeva's Black Sun is that pre-modern forms of life, pre-modern religions, were simply adept at structuring loss. That's what their power was. it just so happens that they did so on the basis of groundless beliefs. But nonetheless, they had an apparatus that allowed them to deal with objection and loss. And we don't have that. And Hegel is, the phenomenology is going to be that, try to be that object, that practice. Okay. So we have moved from the empty thinking of the self in pure insight and faith to what it would be via utility, to what it would be via the notion of absolute freedom. Modernity, which is coming to self-consciousness about itself here, is just the giving up on grounding oneself in any given. That the idea of free self-determination entails, as modern writer after modern writer says, some kind of impossible bootstrapping operation, some trick of pulling oneself up by one's own bootstraps, some impossible gesture like that. And in this case, it occurs by the way in which my will and the general will get connected. So the argument here is that I am free in self-determining, when I will in accordance with the general will. In this setting, what we have then is an attempt at a socialization of the self through a form of willing, and that this socialization occurs if it's the case that my free self-determination is equal to what would be willed by any self who was considering what it would be to be free and self-determined. That is, in thinking that what makes the general will possible for himself, his way of thinking about it, is that I should think of what I consider as a maximal act of free self-determination, that is, what laws I would be willing to obey, if I were just anyone, right? And if each individual thinks in those terms, then what we end up thinking, if we're lucky, is what the general will would will. So, put the question another way, what can I will that is free? And Rousseau suggests that we have to think of what would be good for me in a way that is equally good for everyone. Hegel puts it this way. The general will, he says, comes into existence in such a way that each individual consciousness raises itself out of its allotted sphere, no longer finds its essence and its work in this particular sphere, but grasps itself as the notion of the will, grasps all spheres as the essence of this will, and therefore can only realize itself in a work which is the work of the whole. So before I go on, what's all this stuff about spheres? Spheres are the practices of a community. Spheres are historically sedimented ways of going on. They are what our family practices are, what our economic practices are, et cetera, et cetera. And now we're saying, look, that historical, evolutionary, slow development of these years, that doesn't match the demand for free self-determination. So now I have to take each and every bit of our social practices and put it in relationship to the principle of free self-determination. And in putting it in relationship to the principle of free self-determination, I have to count as naught the fact that this is the way we've always done things around here. I have to count it as naught that this is a perfectly utilitarianly serviceable way of going on. I have to count it as naught that this is practical in use. All of this is just a bit of nature. That's just all nature. The opposite of freedom. So we have to root out all those givens of community, all the givens of history, all those congealed and sedimented practices, everything we might think of as tradition. Therefore, we have to root out, root and branch, Hegel's go on to say, all the various ways that people collect themselves into social groups, into classes, and the like. So he continues. He says, therefore, the general will can only realize itself in a work which is a work of the whole. In this absolute freedom, therefore, all social groups or classes, which are the spiritual sphere into which the whole is articulated, are abolished. So what gets abolished is Sittlichkeit, ethical life. It has to be abolished. And it has to be abolished because they're not grounded in free, self-determining activity. The individual consciousness, Hegel says, that belonged to any such sphere and willed and fulfilled itself in it, has put aside its limitation. Its purpose is the general purpose, its language, universal law, its work, universal work. So paragraph 584. Hegel thinks, and there's a whole subtopic here that's very nicely, by the way, handled in Stern on Hegel's relationship to Rousseau and the French Revolution. And I just want to say here, pages 158 to 161 in Stern. But it's important that here we note that Hegel is not leveling the same criticisms of Rousseau that he does level against him in his later writings. On the contrary, at least here, the argument seems to be that Hegel's interest here is not showing, as it were, that Rousseau is false. His interest here is in showing how Rousseau's doctrine actually does generate or ground or lead to
the French Revolution. So the standard arguments against Rousseau certainly are here not the ones that are going to be at stake. Well, what is important at this juncture is that Hegel thinks that Rousseau's notion of the general will is the means by which utility is turned from a mere desideratum into a concrete actuality. The general will cannot be a mere criterion of legitimacy, which is all that Rousseau intends it to be, right? Rousseau, I should say, was very skeptical about the notion of will. I mean, the opening of his notion of general will is, it's not a will. Right? And he makes a big deal out of that. But Hegel's saying, no. The French Revolution inherited Rousseau, and inherited Rousseau in such a way as to say that it has to be more than a principle. It has to be a real will. So the general will has to be the real harmony, the actual harmony of the general and the particular. And it's therefore, and this is, I take it, the point, it's therefore the attempt to make actual the harmony between universal and particular, which was only an illusory harmony in the Greek world. So the French Revolution is trying to do that, what appeared as that beautiful illusory together of universality, particularly in the Greeks. The French Revolution is, in a certain sense, an attempt to make that actual. This willing, Hegel argues, when put into practice, is the French Revolution, and hence the truth of enlightenment is the general will, and the truth of the general will is the French Revolution, and the French Revolution necessarily, for Hegel, ends in the terror. So Hegel does want to argue that the terra is not an accidental or contingent feature of the French Revolution. He thinks it's intrinsic to the very idea of the French Revolution, and he does think that the French Revolution is a certain performative realization of the underlying principle of modernity as subjectivity, that is, as free self-determination. The crux of those arguments concerning the turning of the French Revolution into the terra happen in paragraphs 589 and 590. So I first want to... How do I want to handle this? I'll just look at a few moments of both of those paragraphs, and then I'll elaborate. So the top of paragraph 589, Hegel says, just as the individual self-consciousness does not find itself in this universal work of absolute freedom qua existent substance, so little does it find itself in the deeds proper and in individual actions of the will of this freedom. So the first problem is, can I, if we put the revolution into practice, can I recognize myself in the product of this attempt to reconstruct society as a whole from the ground up? And Hegel says that this notion of freedom is impossible because it has cut itself off from all possibility of content. That is exactly what would be the content of this free self-determination. How would we determine what is the content? Well, the only conceivable way of doing this is to at least say something like that everyone must will the universal will. That is, the least we can expect is an absolute conformity of all with the will of all. But that's not a content. That's still a form. And therefore, the end of the paragraph, Hegel says, universal freedom, therefore, can produce neither a positive work nor a deed. There is left only negative action. It is merely the fury of destruction. So think about what I said about enlightenment as skepticism, about enlightenment trying to make the object world match its inner sense of validity. Well, now I'm saying that the practical version of that is just the French Revolution, which can only say, well, whatever it is, that's not universal freedom, that's not free self-determination, etc., etc. It can only be this fury of destruction. Paragraph 590. But the supreme reality, and the reality which stands in the greatest antithesis to universal freedom, or rather the sole object that will still exist for that freedom, is the freedom and individuality of actual self-consciousness itself. Okay, right? So, let's skip. No economy, no families, no social relations, no religion. Yeah, okay, all that goes. But surely the one thing that can be in accord with the principle of freedom is freedom. That is, free people determine themselves as free, right? So the idea here is, well, at least we can will the idea of all of us as ourselves actually free and self-determining in a universalistic mode. For that universality which does not let itself advance to the reality of an organic articulation and whose aim is to maintain itself in an unbroken continuity, at the same time creates a distinction within itself because it is a movement or consciousness in general. So, it doesn't allow itself to be a work or world, but it still has a practice. And moreover, by virtue of its own abstraction, it divides itself into extremes equally abstract, into simple, inflexible, cold universality, and into discrete, absolute, hard rigidity and self-willed atomism of actual self-consciousness. That is, the one thing it can hold on to is abstract universality, the principle that this notion of universality that's true of each and every particular is the universality we want. And then if you're going to use that as your criterion, then you have to reduce the individual to their absolute singularity. That is, deprive them of all natural characteristics or qualities or personality, so they become atoms. now that it has completed the destruction of the actual organization of the world and exists now just for itself, this is its sole object, an object that no longer has any content, possession, existence, or outer extension. But this is merely this knowledge of itself as absolute, pure, and free individual self. All that remains of the object by which it can be laid hold of is solely its abstract existence as such. So in order to think serious universality, we have to think serious abstract singularity. That's what universality demands. The relation then of these two, since each exists invisibly and absolutely for itself, and thus cannot dispose of a middle term which would link them together. Obviously that's the clue of what we're going to need, some way of linking them together, is one of wholly unmediated pure negation. A negation, moreover, of the individual as a being existing in the universal. The sole work and deed of universal freedom is therefore death. A death to which has no inner significance or filling, for what is negated is the empty point. Notice what is negated here. Not any rich, complicated human being. What is negated is the empty point of the absolutely free self. It is thus the coldest and meanest of all deaths, with no more significance than cutting off a head of cabbage or swallowing a mouthful of water.
I've already suggested that there is at work here a melancholia, that is, a failure of an acknowledgement of loss. Right? So I'm saying the attempt at self-grounding, I mean, just think of it easily. The attempt at absolute self-grounding is the same as the denial, right, that there's anything out there, right, that there's anything that you could have lost, right? So the notion of absolute freedom as terror is a kind of infinite melancholia of a self that knows no other, that is, in fact, a denial of otherness. Its essence is to recognize no obstacle, no mediating agency, no local nuance or detour that might delay or dilute the passage, and that's what we're trying to get to, the passage from individuality to universality. The question is, Hegel says, but the problem here is there's no mediations between the individual and the universal. So that somehow the goal of the French Revolution is to unite the individual and the universal immediately. And it has to do that, right, by getting rid of anything that would stand in the way of that immediate connection. So what it wants is a movement that is a movement from the universal to the individual and from the individual to the universal back again without any friction, without any resistance. That I should be
absolutely identical with the principle of revolutionary freedom. I should be, you know. I mean, this should just strike us as what's true of every revolution we've known about over the last, well, since the French Revolution. So the idea here is that the individual should fuse themselves with the universal immediately, totally, and without residue. The link between the two sides is abstract individualism. That is, between the right of each against all and the right of all, the universal, against each. So that's the two principles that have to get contradictorily locked together. The right of each against all, that's my free self-determination, and the right of all against each, that's the absolute claim of universality. Now, what all of this does is it shows, or what it's set out against, and I want to continue the argument where Hegel starts it, it entails the loss of the binding power of religion. Religion is about connectedness. Religion is about the social bond. That's all religion is about. Religion is simply the enactment of the social bond as social bond. So the critique of religion, and I want to be clear, what happens is, I've said this before, and I want to say it again, because it's conflated. We have to distinguish between the critique of a transcendent God, which is a pretty silly idea, with the critique of religion. Right? And the idea is that the critique of religion, and by the way, Marx made this mistake, because he modeled the critique of ideology on the critique of religion. And you can think of ideology as simply a version of the conditions of sociality, right? So that, you know, it's not an accident that Marxism ended up in some of the extremes it did. So what the revolution sets out against is the bonds of sociality, and therefore it splinters the community into an aggregate of simply volitional atoms, and it therefore loses any notion of the political. The French Revolution is the political act that forecloses the possibility of politics. Another way of stating this would be to say so we can think now of Polynices, the problem of burying Polynices, as the prototype of the disowned other, the outside that is on the inside. That structure is set up through a repression or denial that will allow no otherness. That's what I meant when I said that suspicion is the epistemology of the French Revolution. Can't find the passage here. I'll find it in a minute. So the reduction of the individual to anonymous oneness there's already the reduction of the individual to an object on the assembly line. And it is therefore a submission to a new idea of sociality as pure rationality. So Hegel's target in discussing the guillotine, what I underlined when I said, what's killed? Not a full person, but an abstract self. So Hegel's target is the paradox of a murder that strips away not only the life, but the antecedent subjectivity of the victim. That is the principle of the guillotine. The guillotine's essential action is to render itself essentially redundant or inessential, because all it does is provide practical confirmation of the object's essential non-existence. To put it another way, it strips even death itself of its singularity and intensity. So the claim that these are abstractions that are killed means there is here a death of death. No object to mourn. So we're in the territory here of what Adorno will call the philosopheme of pure identity. That is, death in its most unsublimated, insignificant uniformity. Modern death. Now, it matters to all of this, therefore, that for Hegel's argument, the terra is therefore essential to the revolution. It belongs to its internal logic of unfolding as how do we want to put it? What's at stake here
is the problem of sovereignty. Sovereignty of the nation.
Right, so the argument is as structurally complete. Why structurally complete?
As purely self-determining. How can you be a self-determining collective subject unless you're one? So you have to be structurally complete.
So as structurally complete, the nation must eliminate what falls outside it as something whose excessiveness is simply a contradiction. This is why the founding of revolutionary democracy is always a purge. Always a getting rid of anyone who does match that. Requiring terror. Is not just the result of a philosophical abstraction. It is itself
a form of abstraction in practice.
That's why it's so terrifying. Terra is what abstraction looks like when it walks the earth. A leaping, to use Rousseau's phrase, from all to all. And that can end only in a repetitive production
of nothing. Only product, Hegel says, is death.
All of this, let's be clear, is what Hegel means by
related to.
So all of this is what we've been thinking about all along. But now it is coming out, and this is the moment of the negative in its pure form. This is why this is, in a way, the heart of the book. That this is the emergence of the principle of the negative, which Hegel says is the self, right? The self is the power of negation, is the same as death, right? All of these now are becoming actual in this moment. So what we have here, however, is nothing but negativity, which is to say nothing but unworked death. And that raises the question, which I've been trying to suggest for the last hour or so, namely, what would a worked death look like? If the problem here is that what we've got is nothing but unworked death, just death as mechanism, then the flip side would be, what does worked death look like? What would mourning look like? What would the acknowledgement of loss look like? Which is the question, what would finitude look like? What would finitude, not as privation, but as constitutive, look like? Right? All of these I take to be the same question. Okay, I need to stop, but what I want to at least end with, and I'll start here next time, is we should not see this moment of negativity as a leading out from what we have been following all along. After all, have we yet seen in this book a happy death? Have we ever seen someone actually buried successfully? Did someone walk away from it? Al-Naisi doesn't get buried, needless to say. But that was equally the problem in that feudal section, right? There could be no... I mean, the negativity in the death haunt us, not because anyone's failing to acknowledge their existence, it's that we don't know what acknowledging that yet means. And if we don't know what acknowledging that means, that is absolute loss, then we don't know what finitude means, and we don't know what finitude means, then we don't know what freedom means, we don't know what subjectivity means. All of these things are getting jammed together at this moment, as homing in on this problem of free self-determination, because free self-determination bears that notion of the negative, necessarily. Okay. Yeah, for next time, certainly start reading Kant, Morality. Well, we'll certainly get well into that next time. Maybe even further.